for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. Welcome to Anti-War Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Scott Horton. This is Chaos Radio, 92.7, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, streaming live worldwide on the internet, KAOS959.com. Check antiwar.com for all the bad news in the whole world, updated all day, every day. My own blog is thestressblog.com, and all my radio archives are at scotthortonshow.com, as well as in the anti-war radio section at the top of the page at antiwar.com. And let's see, you should get some Liberty stickers for the back of your car since you don't have a radio show. You can at least tell people in traffic how much you hate the government. That's libertystickers.com. Especially check the Scott Horton section there. And you could be my MySpace friend, too, if you want. It's myspace.com/Scott Horton with an underscore in there, because I didn't really think about it very hard before I picked my URL and I put an underscore in it. But, yeah, you know. Anyway, you know, myspace.com/Scott Horton, just like Willie Horton. That's how it's spelled. Okay, there you go. Good show lined up today. Only one interview, but it'll be a good one here in just a few minutes. We'll be talking with Michael Scheuer again, the former chief of the Bin Laden Unit 96 through 99 at the CIA. And, of course, we all know that the Alex Station Bin Laden Unit no longer exists. Now, Bush outright lied directly into the cameras when he was asked about it a week after it became news that the Bin Laden Unit had been closed. And he lied and said that that wasn't true, but he's a liar. In fact, it is true. The CIA Bin Laden Unit was closed down. Apparently, they're not even looking for this guy anymore. Maybe he just serves as too good of an excuse to kill everybody but him, huh? Starting to look that way. And, you know, I think what would have been a good comeback for Ron Paul, though, I'm glad he doesn't talk like me. He always does a much better job. But, you know, he could have very easily in the debate the other night said, look, they hate us for our freedoms. We've gotten rid of enough of the Bill of Rights now. I think we should be safe then, if we're to believe you people. And you know as well as I do, like really, if I sat here and tried to catalog through the tips and the Talon and all the different spying programs on your emails, your Carnivore and your Echelon, and I couldn't even keep up with all these things. I couldn't even list them all in 10 minutes. And this one's from the front headlines on antiwar.com today. It's from September 8th, Associated Press. FBI cast wide net when targeting phone records. Telecom firms asked to provide data on suspects' community of interest. Washington FBI demands to telecommunications companies went beyond requesting phone records of customers under suspicion to include analysis of their broader patterns of communication with others as well, newly obtained documents show. Well, you know, what's the point of tapping your phone if we don't get to know who else you're talking to? Come on. We're tracking this guy, Judge. What do you mean we shouldn't be able to know who all else he's talking to, and who all else they're talking to, and who all else they're talking to, and who all else they're talking to? Come on. This is strictly gumshoe work here, right? The Federal Bureau of Investigation used national security letters, that is, warrantless warrants, basically, to request information on the wider community of interest linked to individuals under suspicion, according to documents. The data mining technique can lay bare phone and email links that tie together otherwise indiscernible networks of individuals. Yeah, otherwise indiscernible. That is, they don't exist except in the mind of the police agency working on prosecuting you. Law enforcement officials value that sort of data as a means of identifying a suspect's potential conspirators. Privacy advocates say it can ensnare people with no tie to illegal or suspicious activity. The community of interest requests were included in more than 2,500 pages of FBI documents at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a watchdog group obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. FBI discontinues practice. The FBI letters use boilerplate language to request companies providing calling records for redacted lists of telephone numbers, citing extingent circumstances. An August 9th, 2005 letter and others from that year also include the following. Quote, additionally, please provide a community of interest for the telephone numbers in the attached list. Earlier this year, the Justice Department's Inspector General uncovered 700 cases in which FBI agents obtained telephone records through such exigent letters, which asserted that grand jury subpoenas had been requested for the data when in fact such subpoenas had never been sought. The FBI eliminated the use of the letters earlier this year. The FBI recently stopped asking for community of interest data amid broader questions about the Bureau's aggressive use of national security letters, government officials told The Times. That should be the first part of that paragraph. Well, according to some government officials who told this to The Times, they're not doing this anymore. A federal judge struck down a key part of the USA Patriot Act on Thursday, saying the FBI must justify to a court the need for secrecy if the orders to hand over phone and email records will last longer than a reasonable and brief period of time. Because that's the exception in the Fourth Amendment, right? You guys all have the Fourth Amendment memorized, don't you? Yeah, and it has that big reasonable and brief exception clause in it, right? Oh, wait, no, it doesn't. It's just not the law of the land anymore. See, that's the thing. So, you know, I'm not sure whether I do more harm than good when I talk about things like this, because on one hand, I want people to know that as technology is, you know, growing exponentially, and the integration of all these technologies is just growing in uncountable ways, we have an unlimited government that loves to use every bit of this technology for their purposes, and in fact subsidize a lot of this technology, like biometrics, for example, the retina scans and the finger scans and so forth. There's nothing free market about that technology. It's all been paid for by your tax dollars, all its development and so forth. And and you know, part of me knows, really, or at least entertains the possibility that when people hear stories like this, you know, wow, if I ever talk to Scott Horton on the phone, then that might somehow implicate everybody else I talk to on the phone, or even maybe other people that they talk to, and get, you know, who knows who caught up in some investigation, and therefore they're not going to want to talk to me. They're not going to want to call this show. They're not going to want to go Google around some of the things I advise them to go Google around, right? That's why people don't show up at protests. One of the first lessons about protesting that I learned when I was a little kid was someone I knew back in the 60s went to one or two protests when Nixon was escalating and bombing Laos and Cambodia and so forth. And out of the building where they're protesting the DOD, out come all these DOD guys in civilian clothes with cameras and start taking pictures of everybody. Well, that's kind of intimidating, right? Because that means, you know, whoever this is, there's a manila folder somewhere with his picture in it and proof that he attended an anti-bombing Cambodia protest once. For, you know, I guess as bad as that's supposed to be. And, you know, it has that chilling effect. Well, geez, do I really want a manila envelope with my picture in it somewhere? Do I really want people on my phone list to somehow be incriminated in the conspiracy theory overheated brain of some FBI agent rookie? Goofball? And on the other hand, I also think, you know, that we have to pay attention to the fact that they're using the all this new technology in every way they can to restrict our liberty and our privacy, and the only way anybody's even going to try to stop it is if they know there's a problem. So on one hand, I guess I might be scaring a couple of y'all away, but hopefully at least three or four are, you know, being affected in the other way. And would see something like this, like the FBI keeping track of who, calls who, knows who, in these kind of data mining, fishing expedition sort of maneuvers. Hopefully, you know, it'll drive you people to want to do something about it. Like, oh, just check out the Electronic Freedom Foundation's website, for goodness sake. They got a ton of great information for you there and what you can do about it. All right, this is Anti-War Radio, and we'll be back here in just a couple of minutes to talk Al-Qaeda with Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. Chaos Radio, 95.9 in Austin, Texas. War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. And our guest today is Michael Scheuer. He's the former head analyst at the CIA's Bin Laden Unit, Alex Station, from 1996 through 99, and then as a special advisor to the chief of the Bin Laden Unit after 9/11 through 2004. He's an analyst for CBS News and the Jamestown Foundation. He teaches at Georgetown University. He's the author of the books Through Our Enemy's Eyes and Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. He also writes for antiwar.com, antiwar.com/Scheuer. Welcome back to the show, Mike.
Thank you very much, sir. Glad to be back.
Yeah, good to talk with you again. And it's very timely here with this release of this tape. And let me ask you, I'm a pretty cynical guy. Please forgive me. Why should I believe that this Bin Laden tape is real? He's wearing a fake beard, is what they're saying. What does that mean?
You know, I don't have any idea what it means, but I think the only thing you need to understand, or we all need to understand, is that the voice is his.
You know that voice, and that's certainly his voice, you're saying?
Well, I think I do recognize the voice very well, but also the government, the people who listen to it have confirmed it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so I don't see any reason for anyone to mislead people about that. The beard does look funny. It almost looks to me like the lengthy part of it is tucked in under his chin. But it's you know, I don't know if it's how relevant it is. Of course, in the day of Britney Spears, the whole world is focused on his coif.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I noticed that the video seems to pause.
Yeah.
In a few places, and I really didn't have enough time to go back over it and analyze it closely, but I at least read in a couple of places where they said, hey, you notice that the video pauses at the parts where he mentions Sarkozy and Gordon Brown and other things that refer to current events.
Yeah.
And that isn't that kind of mysterious, that that's where the video pauses. What do you make of that?
Well, there's also stuff after that of current events that he talks about. The thing I read over the weekend in a couple of those communications or computer sites on the internet was that there probably was a glitch in the transmission of the electronic packet that held the speech. But I don't know. You know, you can spin any kind of conclusion you'd like out of it. But I think we'll see the proof of the pudding today or tomorrow in the second half of the speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. There's a news story this morning saying they're going to release a video of Bin Laden, I guess, giving the last rites or something to one of these September 11th hijackers.
Yeah, I think what he did in 02 and 03 is to make a speech and also then present the last will and testament of one of the hijackers. And I think what I heard on the radio was that this was going to be one of the actual pilots.
Hmm. And now, let me ask you this, too, and I'm not just pointing my finger at you. It seems like all these guys, and you included, it seems like you're always so fast to assume that the tape is legitimate even before you've seen it.
Well, we've never had one that wasn't. We kind of have a 12-year track record here of never having an illegitimate tape.
Yeah, and you're convinced of that.
Oh, I'm convinced as far as I can, I have known, you know, in the last two and a half years, my ability to provide technical explanations is certainly not there since I resigned from the agency, but there's no doubt in the world that everyone before November 2004 was produced, was him.
Yeah, and I agree with that, and I know that at least one of those videos is very controversial, where he's sitting in the room and talks about the September 11th attacks, and I've seen a lot of still pictures taken out of that video where people say, ah, see, that couldn't possibly be him. But I went back and watched the video again, and it looks just like him to me, but I've never met the guy. But
yeah, I don't think that it's Scott, I don't think that that was ever intended to be public. That was kind of a home video that somehow got out. That was not at all in the traditional manner in which things were staged. That video, I think, was intended to be taken back by that paraplegic sheikh to Saudi Arabia and to be shown privately there to Bin Laden's backers. I don't think that falls into the category of Al-Qaeda videos, but I do think it's a genuine piece of work.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you've told me before that you consider this guy Bin Laden to be a mastermind. You consider him to be extremely intelligent. Is
extraordinarily
that correct?
So, yes.
And so, then let me ask you, why do you think he mentioned your book?
Because I'm right.
Well, it occurred to me that perhaps he was trying to discredit you.
Well, he might. You know, that's certainly what the pro-Israeli lobby is trying to do over the weekend in that bunch of has-beens up at the Hoover Institute in Stanford. You know, Victor Davis Hanson and Sanuza or Danuza, whatever his name is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. You know, to put me in the same category as Noam Chomsky is a little bit disconcerting. But my books, Scott, are basically based on what he said.
Right.
What I tried to give Americans an idea about is what he was waging war about and what was motivating his followers. So,
well, it seems like, you know, you've told me before that he appreciates this war in Iraq. It was the unexpected but hoped for gift, and we gave it to him, and that he wants to continue this war. And in the transcript, he attacks the Democrats
for not ending
the war. And
yeah.
It seems to me like, well, I mean, we can all just flip it to Fox News right now, and they're saying, you know, see, the Democrats want to end the war, and bin Laden wants them to do it, and they're taking their marching orders from bin Laden, basically, as Chris Wallace accused Ron Paul in the debate.
Well, you know, the only people taking marching orders from Osama bin Laden, as far as I can tell, are every presidential candidate, Mr. Clinton and Mr. Bush, except Mr. Paul. Mr. Paul has it very square about what the motivation of our enemy is, and it's certainly exactly what he said, it is intervention. The rest of them, you know, Chris Wallace, I think really deserves a column, which I hope to write sometime, because really it's the American political establishment that's marching to Al-Qaeda's beat, not Mr. Paul.
Well, I guess it could be marked as some progress, because when Chris Wallace did accuse Ron Paul of treason, basically, he accepted the premise of the question, which was what Al-Qaeda wants is America off the Arabian Peninsula. So he didn't say, you know, oh, come on, Dr. Paul, they don't care about Saudi Arabia, they just hate our freedom.
Well, I guess it might be a small step forward, but it's a very small one.
Yeah, well, this is Fox News. We have to give them credit wherever we can find it, you know? Do you think that he was trying, that bin Laden was basically trying to discredit the Democrats? He was trying to give Fox News ammunition against the people who are trying to end the war here?
You know, I think sometimes that we are a little bit too prone to split hairs here. Bin Laden was given a gift by going there. We're going to leave. And whether you're anti-war or pro-war, when we leave, it will be a defeat for the United States. Bin Laden wins if we stay, wins if we lose. And so I think the bottom line is he'd like to see us leave because he's accomplished his goal. We're much more hated and violently opposed than we were before the invasion of Iraq. But we have to remember that America is not their main enemy. We're hit so frequently in Iraq and Afghanistan, and probably again shortly here in America, because we're in their way, because we protect the Israelis, because we protect the Saudis and the Egyptians. So he doesn't want, bin Laden at heart does not want this war to go on forever against America. He wants to prevail and then move on to their main target.
So basically you think he's gotten all the PR value that he thinks he can get out of Iraq at this point?
Yeah, well, I think what he's weighing is, I think as long as we were there, he's going to get PR value out of it. But we're past the point, you know, we're going to leave one way or another. There's not a lot of difference between Bush and the Democrats. They're going to, once Bush goes, somebody's going to pull out. So the sooner that happens from bin Laden's perspective, the sooner they can claim a great victory, inspire millions of more Muslims to their side, and then begin to focus on our presence in Afghanistan and then go after the police states in the Arab world.
Well, you know that the war party's answer to what you just said is, therefore, we cannot leave. John McCain, he's listening right now, and he's saying, see, Michael Scheuer said it, we have to stay forever.
Well, McCain's got a loose bolt. You know, who's going to vote for president who can't even control his temper enough not to yell at a kid during his rally? There's no difference between McCain and Bush, you know. McCain wants 30,000 more troops. That's not going to do any good. If anybody really intends to win that war, they're going to have to talk 500,000 or more troops, and no one's going to do that. So as far as I'm concerned, every American life lost is there now is wasted, and we ought to get out.
Okay, now you've called this whole Al-Qaeda movement a global Islamist insurgency.
Yes.
Basically. And now, it may just be my understanding of the term, but does that not imply, in its own definition, that there's some sort of oppressive force that they're insurging against? I mean, you can't have an insurgency when you're the boss.
Of course. The oppressive force they're going against initially is us, but just to get us out of the way, the oppressive forces that they have identified that merit demolition are Israel and Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and all of the police states in the Arab world that have oppressed Muslims from their point of view for the past half century.
Mm-hmm. And I think this really gets to the point about what happened on September 11th, right, is that attack was meant to provoke us, to get us to finally go over there and invade with our troops within rifle range in order to cripple the American ability to support the rest of their enemies nearby.
I think that's pretty much right on the mark, that they had been, if you read what bin Laden has said in 96, 97, 98, he began to goad us, trying to get us on the ground in Afghanistan. And there are some people who said, well, I think George Tenet said he never expected us to invade Afghanistan. I think that's exactly wrong. I think that's just a lot of baloney. I think what he wanted was us on the ground in order to kill us at rifle range, just as you said.
And then they almost denied him the battle in Afghanistan that he wanted by going to Iraq, but then I guess they ended up keeping enough of an occupation in Afghanistan to make both true.
Yeah, they've divided forces just to the right amount that we can lose both wars. it's almost mathematical in the way they've done it, but they've ensured that they can't win in either place.
Yeah, you said on one TV show or another last week or in print somewhere that the mission in Afghanistan as it is now is to suppress drugs and support the Taliban and fight an insurgency here and put down a rebellion there. And it's everything but look for the Arab-Afghan army, the leftover al-Qaeda Mujahideen types.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I'm surprised that American parents of servicemen in Afghanistan aren't more distraught than they are. I don't think they realize that those few American servicemen and women and intelligence officers have six top priority jobs on their plate, which would probably require 500,000 people if you wanted to do them all simultaneously.
And you're not advising to do that. You're advising to drop some of those commitments that are relevant to the real fight, or you are advising 500,000 troops?
You know, Scott, we've drifted over the past 6 years into a position where we cannot that we're under attack there. The idea that we're on the offensive there in any of these categories is incorrect. We're under attack. We really don't have enough people if we don't fight the Taliban, for example, they'll keep attacking us and hurt us while we're trying to focus on bin Laden. If we don't fight to keep Karzai in power, he's dead insofar as a functioning political entity. So right now, not only do they have six top priority issues to look at and to work against, but in some ways they're all interconnected. They weren't that way when we went there, but once we decided instead of beating al-Qaeda and the Taliban, we wanted to a secular democracy and a parliament and the elections and all of this stuff, it's now all interwoven. So I think at the end of the day, we're probably closer to losing in Afghanistan than we are in Iraq.
Well, now, would you say that, listen, we're going to lose Afghanistan one way or another, we ought to go ahead and leave there the way you say about Iraq?
Not yet, because I still think it's very important that we at least have a try at bin Laden, even if he's in Pakistani territory. You know, I think I don't know what Mr. Paul thinks on this, but I find it a little bit contrary to the Constitution that the last two American presidents have delegated the protection of our country to a third world dictator in the person of Musharraf. I think ultimately, if we wanted bin Laden, we're going to have to do it ourselves.
Well, now there's a cost-benefit analysis to be taken there. I mean, if we send soldiers across the Pakistani border, that could lead to some serious upset in that country, and they're armed to the teeth with nukes.
And if we don't, we let maybe a nuke go off in one of our cities. It's not an easy decision, but it was a much easier decision to make in 2001 when we had the opportunity. It's like anything else, Scott. We didn't kill him in 98. We didn't kill him in 99. We didn't kill him in 2001. Now we're this far down the road, and we're faced with exactly the same problem, but within a much more complex context.
Now, you often bring up the idea of a nuclear attack on the United States by these guys. What is it that you know that makes you so certain that they want to attack us with a nuclear weapon?
Well, aside from the promises they've made in public, whether it's Zawahiri or bin Laden, we know that since 1992, they have had a unit of hard scientists and engineers and technicians trying to either buy a nuclear weapon or steal one. We also know that for them, money is no object. We know that they went to the bother of getting a religious validation for an attack that allows them to kill up to 10 million Americans. And finally, we know that our government has been absolutely negligent since 1991 in not fully securing the Soviet nuclear arsenal. The one thing that we were in complete control of with the Russians was putting 22,000 Soviet nuclear weapons under wraps. And the last time I heard Senator Lugar talk, he said less than 40% of that program has been completed. So you add up all that stuff, Scott, and I think we can hope that it doesn't happen, but the conditions that would promote it are very much in the favor of the enemy.
Do you have any reason to believe that they already possess a nuclear weapon?
I really don't have any way to know one way or another. But if you leave a window open for, since the wall fell, 91, that's nine, for 16 years, you'll probably get to the point where it's like they say you can put a monkey in front of a typewriter and eventually he'll type a poem.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the kind of condition we're in. We've given them a 17-year window of opportunity.
Have you read Dying to Win by Robert A. Pape?
I have, yes.
And what's your opinion about that?
I think it's an excellent book. I try to promote it whenever I can. I have a little question about Dr. Pape's secondary emphasis on the role of religion, but I think in the suicide bombings, at least in the Islamic world, but I think his data is irrefutable. The American military presence, foreign military presence, produces suicide bombings. It seems pretty cut and dried to me.
Well, and now about that role of religion, you know, the war party says, oh, Islamofascism, they're an aggressive, Fourth Reich, bent on taking over the world and that sort of thing.
That's just propaganda by the pro-Israeli bloc, Scott. You know, there are Islamofascists out there, but they're all on our side. The president of Egypt, the kings of all the Persian Gulf countries, including Saudi Arabia, the governmental junta of generals in Algeria. So, unfortunately, America's lined up with the fascists, the Islamofascists.
Well, now, in Pape's book, he says the role of religion, I guess what you call a kind of a secondary emphasis on it. He says the role of religion here, the most important thing to know is it's the difference in religion between the occupier and the occupiee that causes the motivation. The Iraqis didn't resort to suicide bombing against the Iranian invasion because it wasn't such an alien force coming that was a threat to their culture, their way of life, whereas this is a bunch of, you know, pale-faced Christians from across the ocean who come and don't speak the language, aren't anything alike. And I guess he points at Sudan and says, you know, this is the place with the most radical Wahhabists, and they kill each other, but they don't use suicide bombing. And it's because they don't have that difference of religion. They don't have, even though they're being attacked, they don't feel like their entire way of life is being threatened.
Well, you know, Dr. Pape has done an extraordinary job in researching this issue, and I think there's a little bit of difference between him and me on this, but I think he's going to be proven right in the Sudan when Senator Dole or former Senator Dole and Senator McCain get their way and they deploy American and British troops to Darfur. I think we'll certainly see the beginning of suicide bombings then.
Yeah. Well, so then what is your perspective on the role of religion here in terms of motivation?
The most important part is of that religion plays is bin Laden speaks for almost 75% of all Muslims, according to Western polls. When he describes U.S. foreign policy, U.S. interventionism, as an assault on Islam and a threat to Muslim believers. That's the most important thing, and that's where the motivation comes from. I think motivation for suicide car bombings is a subset of that. There's a bigger kind of motivation for actual warfare, which we're seeing in the various insurgencies in the world. But that's the key. And for Americans to keep being told by their leaders that this just is all about our primary elections and ladies in the workplace and freedom is wrong. And I think what bin Laden said when he mentioned my book was simply that maybe he thought it would be better understood by Americans if they read it by an American. I don't think he realizes quite the desperateness of our political establishment not to have my book be very well received in the country.
Well, you know, it's interesting that they keep trying to push this Hate Us for Our Freedom line. They must know. They've read your book, right, over there in the halls of power in the foreign policy establishment. They know who you are, Michael Scheuer. If they haven't read bin Laden's fatwas, they've at least read your American angle on them. And so is it too much of a stretch for me to conclude that they've just decided that 3,000 dead Americans every once in a while is worth it for their global empire, and that's why they can't tell us the truth about it? They know that the American people in supermajority, if faced with the real question, is it worth it to have our civilians killed just so that we can control other people's countries, would say no. And that's why they're lying to us, is because they don't want us to have that debate.
I think that's a large part of it. Scott, I think they are moral cowards, and I think they are very loath to talk about anything that could take them, cost them office, whether it's border control, Israel, oil and energy. But I have to tell you that all of the leading lights in this administration, at least, keep identifying my book as an anti-Bush book. And Mr. Bush is mentioned in about three pages of a 340-page book, so I don't know if they have read it or not. The only person I'm confident of who has looked at it and thought about it is Mr. Paul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you're only the former chief of the bin Laden unit. What could you have to say that anybody in American policy circles could learn from? I don't know.
Well, you know, the one thing I don't want to be is known as the expert. I don't know if there's any expert on this at all. I'm a guy that's worked in the vineyard for a little while, and I'm putting up a view. And I think it makes a little bit of sense because the other view, the opposite view, clearly hasn't worked in the last decade.
Let me ask you about this. I don't think we've ever discussed this. You mentioned earlier that they failed to get him, bin Laden, in 1999. And that reminded me of all the different reports I've read that America actually was working with, maybe not directly with bin Laden, but at least with his Mujahideen warriors in 1999, bringing them in from Afghanistan and using them as shock troops in the war in Kosovo. What do you know about that?
I know that it's not true. Primarily because bin Laden didn't want to go to the Balkans. I don't know if we would have ever, and he hates us from the word go, but he is very careful not to commit major numbers of his fighters to places where they don't have contiguous territory and safe haven. He grew up in the war against the Soviets, and he looks wherever he goes for a Pakistan. And one of the, for example, they didn't go to the Balkans because they couldn't base out of Catholic Croatia or Protestant or Orthodox Serbia. And bin Laden and Zawahiri have railed consistently against Lebanon and Jordan in Syria for not letting them base there to attack the Israelis. One of the things they value most, Scott, about Iraq is Iraq, for the first time, gives them contiguous territories not only next to the Levant, but next to Turkey and the Arabian Peninsula. So, you know, I was at the heart of the business in the Balkans, and I knew of no contacts ever between Al-Qaeda and the United States government.
Well, what about any sort of Mujahideen types from Afghanistan coming to fight on the side of the Kosovars? No?
Oh, sure, they certainly went there. A lot of them went there. A lot went from Egypt. A lot went from Europe. But bin Laden's aid, I'm not saying he didn't help those people, but his aid was limited primarily to things like documents, money, a few advisors. but not a body of troops such as he has deployed in Afghanistan at the moment. Yeah, I'm not saying his hands were not in there. Surely they were. But in terms of a major effort, the configuration geographically just did not conduce to what bin Laden wants before he commits.
Mm. And to the degree that he was involved, it was on the same side as the United States?
I don't, you know, I'm not quite sure what side we were on, except
well,
we wanted...
we were on the side of the KLA.
Well, then, if there were bin Laden people there and we were supporting the KLA, then certainly we were both on the same side. I doubt that, that we were in any kind of contact.
Mm-hmm.
I would be very, very surprised. I would never say never, but I would be very surprised.
Yeah, I don't know enough about it to really
frankly,
continue
Scott, that's a good way to put it, because I don't either.
Yeah.
I know Brendan
O'Neill has written a whole book about this, about how this really helped all the liberal do-gooderism in Bosnia and especially in Kosovo helped internationalize al-Qaeda far beyond what they were before.
Well, the one thing I know from my own studies is that the West does not appreciate the really dramatic, almost traumatic effect the Balkans had in the Muslim world. The behavior of the Serbs and the Croatian, especially toward Muslim children and women, had a far greater impact in the Muslim world than in the West. And the animosities that were stirred by that were really very, very much a monumental point in contemporary history. And I think we have not heard the last of Islamic insurgency in the Balkans by a long shot.
All right, now I'm looking at the clock here, and I'm looking at my list of questions. We're going to have to really go through these quick here. Your most recent article for antiwar.com is something to the effect of Iran and Syria, the enemies that aren't.
Yeah.
And it's pretty clear that these two countries are on the administration's hit list. There's more and more information coming out all the time about seemingly well-connected people expressing fears that we really are about to bomb Iran sometime soon and so forth. So I wonder if you can help the audience understand America's conflict with Iran and Syria in terms of America's conflict with Osama bin Laden, which, since he knocked down the towers, would seem to be first and foremost the problem here.
The problem is he's not first and foremost. This administration, and I'm afraid both parties, really are still stuck in the Cold War. They think that the only real threats can come from nation states. And really, this is a perfect example of America being involved in two potential wars just because of our relationship with the Israelis. Iran is no threat to the United States. And Syria, my God, look at Syria on the map. It's a little splotch, and it's dirt poor, and it's no threat to anybody but the Israelis. Iran is surrounded by a Sunni world that hates it. It's running out of energy over the next decade or two. It's going to revert to being an impoverished third world country. And it's also ringed by American military bases. If they're a threat to the United States, it's hard for me to figure out why. There's always classified information that I have no access to. So, you know, you have to at least give your government people the benefit of the doubt. But on the surface of them, neither one seems to be a threat to me. Certainly neither one of them is going to detonate any kind of weapon inside of an American city.
Well, you know, Eli Lake in the New York Sun says that the Iranians are in bed with al-Qaeda, that, oh, yeah, they say that they're in prison, but really they're all working together and directing anti-American operations from Iran.
It always seems to me that most of the news out of the New York Sun is probably manufactured by the propaganda bureau of the Mossad. The idea that the Sunnis and Shias are cheek by jowl is a fabrication of somebody's either imagination or their deliberate intent to mislead Americans. Now, the one thing that could promote that really historic bridging of animosities between Shias and Sunnis would be an American attack on Iran. That could be a negative achievement of truly historic proportion.
But that hasn't taken place up to this point, you're saying?
No, it has not. There is no significant cooperation between the Iranians and al-Qaeda, no. First of all, the Iranians would have to be idiots. Whatever al-Qaeda does benefits Iran without Iran getting bombed in return. But second, bin Laden has been studious in avoiding any kind of state sponsor relationship with anyone. Why would he go to people that he hated, like the Shia?
Well, I can only think of one reason, and it's from one of the letters they found at Zarqawi's place when they killed him. And it was, they want America to have a war with Iran. I guess if bin Laden could make it look like he's friends with Iran, that would help provide Cheney the excuse he needed. I don't know why the Iranians would want to make that deal.
Yeah, and you know, if that was the case, I think, given what we know about al-Qaeda's propaganda machine and its sophistication, if they wanted to do that, I think they could have done a much better job than they have so far.
In trying to get America to bomb Iran?
Yes. But the problem is the constituency bin Laden speaks to, to the people who are going to come out and support him with guns, who are going to fight, would be turned off by the idea of any kind of an alliance with the Shia. I think that's why we haven't seen that kind of program.
So you don't think that he would consider it a hoped-for but unexpected gift for America to bomb the Ayatollahs out of power?
Well, I don't think we can bomb anybody out of power unless we use nuclear weapons. Air power has never won anything.
Yeah.
I don't think he would frown on it at all. All I'm saying is that I haven't seen evidence to point to the kind of effort al-Qaeda is capable of in terms of convincing America that they and the Iranians are allied.
Right. I see what you're saying. Okay, now, the war's already spreading to Africa. We mentioned Sudan and some of the Democrats' vows to put American combat troops on the ground there. And, of course, there's a proxy war being fought in Somalia. Is this a good strategy to hunt al-Qaeda guys down with military force in Africa, or are we just going to spread this whole global Islamist insurgency further west at this point?
In Africa, my impression that the way to handle things is quietly, either by capturing al-Qaeda people that we know of or killing them. I'm afraid that increased American military presence on the ground is just going to spread a jihad in a place where very little has occurred that's beneficial to bin Laden. But now we're in about 12 different African states. We're supporting a Christian army from Ethiopia that invaded an Islamic country in Somalia. And it seems like either wittingly or unwittingly, we're trying to spread this business.
Well, if it's unwittingly, there's a real lack of wits going on, it would seem. The Washington Post reported that there were 3 al-Qaeda guys in Somalia justify this war. Now, it's hard for me to believe that's just myopia. That's, taking advantage. That's taking an excuse to do something you wanted to do anyway at that point.
That could well be. You know, I think that's a fair point, Scott. But I also think that this administration is particularly operating for whatever reason from a basis of fear. At the end of the day, one of the best things that could have happened to America was to have the Islamists rule Somalia. They were bringing order and peace and a harsh law and order, to be sure. But at the same time, once they had a state, they had something to lose. And people with something to lose are much easier to keep in line than people who you can't find and locate and kill. So, to me, the whole Somalia thing was there's just very little contact with reality in it. I don't understand it, except if you look at it in the context of people just wanting to extirpate this Muslim phenomenon wherever they can find it.
Now, back to Iraq here for a minute. The president, I guess the story changes. You know, one week it's everyone fighting Americans in Iraq is al-Qaeda, and then the next week it's, al-Qaeda's on the run because we've turned the Sunni against them, although it seems like the Sunni turned against them themselves, the regular Sunni Iraqi population. But the threat that the president has used over and over and over again is that if we leave Iraq, and I'm sorry, this also goes for many of the Republican presidential and Democratic presidential candidates as well, if we leave Iraq, then al-Qaeda in Iraq will take over and will use that as their new base of operations.
That's nonsense, Scott. You know, I think, it's as you say, it's hard to tell what the story is, because one day we're going to bring all of al-Qaeda in Iraq to justice one person at a time, and then they talk about Anbar, and they talk about al-Qaeda as if it was a 10,000-person force that they had to defeat conventionally or with the Sunnis. I don't know what the truth is there, but to identify the opposition in Iraq as Al-Qaeda, mainly, is certainly a lie. First of all, there's not enough Al-Qaeda people to do what's going on in Iraq at the moment. Second, Al-Qaeda is only welcomed in other countries, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the Philippines, in Yemen, if it comes to play a supporting role and let the national insurgency, the Iraqi insurgency, the Yemeni insurgency, take the lead. One of the reasons Zarqawi, for example, was causing them such a problem, Al-Qaeda, was because he was a Jordanian and he was trying to take over the leadership of the Iraqi insurgency. Zawahiri's letter to Zarqawi in June of 2005, or July of 2005, was very clear on that point. He said, you cannot be the leader. All you will do is get us kicked out of the country.
So, well, what happens if American troops leave? Then you think the local Sunnis will just clean them out and that'll be the end of that?
No, I think once we leave, the Sunnis will make peace with what's left of Al-Qaeda and then fight with the Shias. The Sunnis there know we're going to leave, and they know they're going to need help in the future, so they're not going to, they'll fight them now, but they're not going to destroy them.
Well, so then I get that does sound like you're saying, well, they will have a safe haven there then.
Oh, sure, they'll have a safe haven no matter what happens. As long as Iraq is unstable or if it has an Islamic government, they have a safe haven. That's what people don't seem to get, that it's not that if we leave Iraq, they'll have a safe haven. They have a safe haven.
Because we invaded.
Because we invaded, and because there's no entity in Iraq at the moment that controls the borders. Where those problems that they're having in Algeria, the problems in Egypt, the fighting that went on for 4 months in Lebanon, that's the first indication of the seepage of Al Qaeda out of Iraq into the Levant. And, the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis have said Al-Qaeda is in Gaza, too. I don't know whether I trust them or not, but it's not impossible.
Well, now, so do you think that this new generation of jihadists, then, that have grown up fighting the Iraq war, that they basically are tantamount to the same threat as Osama bin Laden in terms of, coming here and killing Americans?
No. I think the problem we have from the core Al-Qaeda group is that we didn't destroy it. It's still functioning. And it's still focused on us. And it doesn't take an awful lot of people to stage an attack in the United States when our borders are open. I think what the other groups are just going to be fighting primarily in their own countries. I think in some ways the generation that's coming of age in Iraq is probably more of a threat, at least at this stage, to Europe than it is to America.
They're sort of the junior Mujahideen.
Right now. They don't have as much experience or talent, but it's always a learning curve, Scott. And they'll learn as they go. When we were first attacked by Al-Qaeda in 92, Al-Qaeda blew itself up in Yemen. And 9 years later, they hit us in New York and Washington. So people who kind of make fun of the amateurish attempts we've seen recently are really whistling past the graveyard because people learn over time.
Let me ask you real quick, if I can, about the economics of Osama bin Laden, his denunciations of corporations and capitalism in this recent speech kind of remind me of the most radical leftist. And I've read him compared to a Leninist before in terms of his hatred of markets and so forth. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I think that was the one discordant note that I caught in the speech, is that previously he's been posing as, or at least, talking as a capitalist. He sees how the economy works. He's an economist, trained as an economist and an engineer. And he's always said, well, what do the Americans think I'm going to do with the oil? But I'm going to sell it to them, but they're going to pay more for it. I think what we saw in the speech last Friday was the influence, to some extent, of the American that's working with him now, Adam Gadan, the guy they call Azam al-Amriki. But it's not a theme that's new to Al-Qaeda. It's a theme that bin Laden or al-Zawahiri has been focusing on since 2005. The inequities of capitalism, the poor people in our country, and more recently trying to point out racial inequalities, especially vis-a-vis the number of blacks that are being killed in the military actions around the world. So it's a little different for bin Laden, but it's not new. It's just more developed a theme than it has been before. And I think the main thing he's trying to do is to contrast the capitalist, the failings of the capitalist society, if you will, to the pleasures of Islam, the all-encompassing philosophy that Islam presents for humans.
Yeah. I try to beware of all-encompassing philosophies.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, now a couple last footnotes here, if I can squeeze them in. Before the war against Iraq, you were assigned, correct, to go back and double-check all the evidence about Saddam Hussein's connection to al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And you had already written a book, Through Our Enemy's Eyes, that detailed vast and extensive links and ties between these two groups. And then that's what you found, right, when you went back through the CIA's material?
No, I found nothing. You know, my books are based on open source material, and I don't think I described a vast and extensive coordination between Iraq and al-Qaeda, but I did mistakenly describe a relationship that was developed between them on WMD in Sudan, when Tarabi was the leader in Sudan. I went back at the direction of the DCI and examined with several other officers about 10 years worth of the intelligence community's records, about 20,000 documents, about 80,000 pages of material, and we found nothing. There was no connection at all. And so in the subsequent edition of Through Our Enemy's Eyes, I recanted what I had said and explained how I had come to a wrong conclusion and why I was recanting.
And you told the director of Central Intelligence this before
yes.
the war?
Yes, of course.
You didn't keep this a secret from Mr. Tenet?
No.
Oh, okay.
Well, I have to explain to you, it was a two-tiered thing. We did the research, the team that I led, and then the analysts wrote it up. But I saw what the analysts wrote, and it basically said, there's nothing here, boss. What he passed on to the president is an entirely different issue. I have no idea what he told the president.
Mm-hmm. And one last thing. There have been many terrorism prosecutions here in the United States, and I want to exclude Zacharias Moussaoui because he was connected. But Lodi, California, Brooklyn, Miami, the New Jersey Army Base, the JFK Airport, the Detroit Four, all these terrorism cases. In your opinion, are any of these guys actually members of al-Qaeda or tied to al-Qaeda? And I guess secondly, are any of them even terrorists at all?
It looks like the Fort Dix guys perhaps were a serious threat. And the guys earlier in Lackawanna near Buffalo, New York. But as I understand the rest of those cases, it was entrapment. That the FBI found unintelligent group of Muslims, then found a slightly more intelligent Muslim who was wanted for something and promised him a plea deal if he would go back to the group of unintelligent Muslims and entrap them in terrorism. So I think, you know, a couple of these cases were real. A couple of them just looked like ordinary run-of-the-mill sting operations.
Well, so if you were having lunch with the director of the FBI, what would you say to him about this? I mean, it seems to me like the more time these guys spend running around playing Keystone Cops, the more likely it is that some actual terrorists are actually going to get away with another spectacular attack in this country.
Well, the FBI is not very good at counterterrorism. They probably should have been taken away from them, and we should have had a MI5-type system established after 2001. Somebody's got to do the job, but to give the FBI their due, and all law enforcement, they don't have a chance to stop anything in this country of a serious nature as long as our borders are open. At the end of the day, if we get attacked again, the FBI, the CIA, the local police, they'll be blamed. But the real murderers of the next group of Americans won't be bin Laden, but the Congress that didn't close the borders.
And you think that's the most likely entry for some terrorists is to come across like Mexican laborers?
Yeah, or from Canada. You know, when I was a kid, I lived in Buffalo, and we used to run beer across the border in a boat, you know, three or four times a week. And I don't think in 10 years I ever saw anybody that even looked like law enforcement. We've got an awful long border on both sides, north and south. So unless we're going to be serious about that, talking about effective homeland security is really a hoot.
All right. Well, we're all out of time. I really appreciate your perspective today. Everybody, Michael Scheuer, he's the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden Unit, Alex Station, He's the author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. You can find his archives at antiwar.com/Scheuer. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir. It's always a pleasure.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it.
Welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I am Scott Horton. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. And the phone number here is 512-646-6446. 512-646-6446. Give a call. Everybody's got a lot to say about all kinds of things, except never on this show. I'm not sure why, but I know you're out there, so... And I know that you got a cell phone and the long distance is free. So go ahead and call in 512-646-6446. Yeah, what the hell? It's September 10th. That's close enough. If you guys want to talk about 9/11 conspiracy theory stuff that, you know, you wish I would say, but I never do or whatever like that, then go ahead and call in. I know everybody's always, champing at the bit to discuss that stuff. I'll go ahead and entertain that if you guys want to discuss that. Talk about Al-Qaeda and so forth and this and that. And, of course, I also have a list of other things to talk about, too. to get to later in this hour. Again, that number is 646-6446, 512-646-6446. Hey, I'm Scott. You're on the show.
Hey, Scott. This is Nickel P in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good, man. I really enjoyed your interview you just had. Sounds like you guys take your marching orders from Al-Qaeda, though.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, I just, I really, all I wanted to do is call in and say Ron Paul's here, and I've been out running around Northwest Arkansas all weekend, you know, trying to spread the good news about the constitutionalists, and the reaction I've been getting from people is so encouraging.
Really?
Freedom, yeah, because people want to be free, man.
So you walk up to strangers who don't know about Ron Paul, and you tell them what?
I tell them, well, you know, a good way to break the ice is to say, hey, do you believe in upholding the Constitution? Which is usually they say yes, and you say, hey, well, you know, there's only one candidate out there who's, you know, talking about that at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I've been making CDs of his interview at the Google campus.
Uh-huh. Oh, which is a great interview, man. That's the best one. Absolutely.
After you hear that, you know, I was on board 100%. And I've got a yard sign on the bike rack on my bicycle, so I don't have to put the sign out everywhere. They'll just have to look at it when I ride by.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Well, I have to tell you, I want to thank you personally for any effort that you're doing on behalf of Ron Paul, because anything that you do on behalf of Ron Paul is to benefit my liberty. And,
yeah,
you know,
it's going to take every single one of us, but if we all do it together, we're there. Individualists unite.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you something. It sounds crazy. I know it. Well, I'm not sure how crazy it sounds anymore. Maybe that's the point. I'm not sure how crazy it sounds anymore to entertain the possibility that Ron could actually get this nomination. I mean, the fact of the matter is, nobody loves Mitt Romney or John McCain or Rudy Giuliani. They have to pay people to show up. You know, they're pathetic, all of them, for their various different reasons. And you know, it seems like we Ron Paul fans are pretty motivated compared to the fans of these other guys. And we still got 6 months before the primaries. An article where they said they were quoting a Giuliani or a Obama or somebody spokesman trashing Ron Paulians, you know, because, you know, we're all a bunch of marginal types or whatever it was. And then they had an election expert on there who said, oh, are you kidding me? Any other presidential campaign out there would kill to have Ron Paulians like this. I mean, this spontaneous campaign pushing Ron Paul along here is something that any other of these candidates would absolutely kill for. And they don't have it. And they will not have it either.
Oh, for sure. And this is something that you've said, but they're scared to death of this guy. And they don't know what to do about him. And the only thing they can try to do is just try to defame him. You know, because they can't confront his arguments because he's right.
Right. You know, I read the funniest thing. It was a pro-Huckabee guy. And he said, oh, Huckabee, don't fight with Ron Paul, dude. You can't go toe-to-toe with Ron Paul when it comes to the facts. And I don't know why this guy thought he still preferred Huckabee, since Huckabee was wrong on the facts. But he said, oh, you have to understand that this guy, Ron Paul, is a serious heavyweight. You cannot go toe-to-toe with him. He will thrash you.
Yeah, he's a true statesman.
Yeah, and see, and here's the cool thing, you know, he's right, and so it's really not hard for him to win any arguments with these people. They got nothing, you know. We have to be one nation under God. Like, yeah. Is that the best you can do? Get out of here.
Well,
that's my take.
I don't know, man. I think he did an awesome job because he had the right answer. He said, you know, our government made a mistake, and our job to fix it.
Yep.
Yeah,
their jaws hung open. They didn't know what to say.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm fighting a good fight for you guys up in Northwest Arkansas, and if you ever get around here, I'll buy you a beer.
All right, cool, man.
Thanks for calling in. All right, bye.
Take it easy. All right, y'all, this is Anti-War Radio. The number is 646-6446, 512-646-6446. You guys mean to tell me you don't want to call in and try to get me to address Building 7? Well, what about Building 7? Well, what about Building 7? You're not going to call in? You're not going to call in and ask me to explain why it's not obvious that Dick Cheney did that attack himself or something? Not that that's impossible, you know. I wouldn't be surprised if Dick Cheney flew all four of those planes that day, really, at this point. Nothing would surprise me there, but. Okay, that's fine. You guys don't want to talk about 9/11 conspiracy theories? Good. Because I really don't want to either, but I just figured you guys would, and I never let you, so here would be your opportunity, but there you go. But, yeah, so Michael Scheuer had a lot of things to say there. The thing that really bothers me is Bin Laden seeking and obtaining religious justification to kill millions of Americans. Jeez. Can't you just seek, you know, justification to kill thousands of us? Millions, huh? And I'll tell you, that Osama bin Laden is a collectivist son of a gun, man. Did you guys read that transcript? Oh, yeah. You re-elected George Bush, so you all deserve to die, he said. $56 million out of $300 million show up to re-elect George W. Bush, and we all have to pay. In the eyes of bin Laden. What a commie. He reminds me of Mike Huckabee. What is all this collective responsibility? When our government does something wrong, the American people must pay the price? What are Mike Huckabee and Osama bin Laden talking about? Are they crazy? Don't they know that people are individuals? What, they think we're all, you know, connected to each other at the pinky finger? My responsibility is yours and vice versa? Osama bin Hucka Marx. What kind of sick commie thinking is that? That any American's life is forfeit because of the actions of our government. Like bin Laden and Mike Huckabee say. That's just crazy. I don't think you have to be an ideological libertarian to see the fallacy in killing innocent people to make a statement of some sort. I really should have had the audio. I'm sorry, I've fallen down on the job here, guys. I should have the audio for you of Thomas Friedman. But you can look it up. You can watch the whole video online as Thomas Friedman from the New York Times explains to Charlie Rose, could have been Saudi Arabia. Could have been Pakistan. Could have been anybody. America had to invade a Middle Eastern country and go door to door, in this case, from Basra to Baghdad, just to say to these people, what part of this sentence don't you understand? You think you have a little bubble over the Middle East? Well, we're popping it. And then Thomas Friedman literally used these words on the Charlie Rose show. You can suck it, he said. Thomas Friedman, who writes in the biggest paper in America. Doesn't matter that no one, not a single individual in Iraq, had anything to do with the attacks on America on September 11th. No. A Saudi in Afghanistan arranged for some Egyptian and Yemenese grad students to hijack some planes. And to Thomas Friedman, that means that all Arabs and all Muslims are collectively guilty. Yeah, not just Arabs. All Muslims. Could have been Saudi Arabia, could have been Pakistan. We just had to make an example out of a few hundred thousand innocent people somewhere or another. This is the collectivist thinking of Mike Huckabee and Thomas Friedman and Osama bin Laden and Dick Cheney. That's, in fact, George Bush once defined the terrorists as people who kill people in order to achieve a goal. Huh. That's, if that's what makes a terrorist, Mr. Bush, You guys can finish the thought yourselves. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
With regard to the Bin Laden tape, a couple of interesting things. One is, not only was there that weird discussion about capitalism and how the economy fails, but Bin Laden starts to talk about global warming and says that global warming caused by the U.S. and Western populations is going to kill, I don't know, thousands, millions, whatever. The funny thing is, if we were to do, the one thing we would do if we were to do anything about global warming is cut back on our carbon dioxide emissions, which means cut back on petroleum consumption.
Mm-hmm.
That would probably be the last thing in the world that would benefit Bin Laden's constituency. It seemed kind of weird in that respect.
Hmm.
I don't know what Bin Laden was thinking when he was complaining about global warming, because he would like to be able to sell us oil, or at least he said so before. And
right.
The global warming rant was a little weird. The other thing, too, is just in reading that transcript, I kind of got the opposite impression about him holding us collectively guilty. What he said in there was, you elected the Democrats to stop the war in Iraq, but they're continuing it. He was saying basically your democracy has failed you, and then he went into his rambling discussion of the Islamic Caliphate or whatever it is he likes. But he was saying that he was not holding he was acquitting the American people, I think, from what I saw in there.
Hmm. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, basically the gist of it, and I'll just repeat myself briefly, was because I tried and stated it clearly, but he said, you elected the Democrats to stop the war, and your democracy has failed you in this respect. And there was a lot also there about him talking about Rumsfeld. I mean, a whole lot. He was even blaming the Vietnam War on Rumsfeld and Cheney, if I could remember correctly, which was kind of a weird thing. It looks like he's focused more, if there was a threat, I think the threat is actually against individuals like Rumsfeld and not against the American public, because he was saying, you voted to stop the war, and it looks like democracy is failing you. So.
Well,
that was my take on it.
That's an interesting point. I guess my response to that would be, you know, I mean, you're right. He does come out and even say the vast majority of you are opposed to this war. But then he says, basically, he still says, you reelected Bush, and then you say you're not guilty. You know, you in a mm-hmm. pretty collective sense there.
Yeah.
And he also basically is inviting all of us to embrace Islam, because our problem is we have democracy and capitalism, and that's why these evil people keep doing their evil things. And so it's incumbent upon all of us, it seems like he's saying, to go ahead and embrace his way of looking at the world. That'll end this war. And I actually wish I had asked Michael Shorter about this specifically, but I did see him on a TV show earlier, I guess over the weekend or late last week, where he talked about, making an offer to you that, hey, you ought to convert is required by their version of Islam before they kill you. And so mm-hmm. that should be taken very much as a threat, you know, according to Michael Shorter anyway.
Okay.
Interesting point, though. I mean, you're right, because he does come right out and say, the vast majority of you, which he's right about that, it is a super majority of the American people now who want out of Iraq. He does say the vast majority of you are against this war. And, you know, I hate to say it, but when he goes on and talks about, you know, the reason we have this war is because we have this democracy and this so-called capitalism where the corporations can just buy politicians. It's the cheapest investment in the world. I think in the phrase, a congressman or a dime a dozen, senators, two bits. And he's right. That, of course, is why we're in a permanent state of war right now. And democracy indeed has failed us, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, to a certain extent, it has.
Are you still there?
Oh,
okay. I'm sorry. You cut off it. Just...
Okay. You also mentioned in there that you were surprised at his mention of Michael Shorter. I think the reason he mentioned Michael Shorter is one of the things Shorter has repeatedly said almost any time he's in front of a camera is our politicians have not told us the truth about why Bin Laden has attacked us. And I think that was the reason he invoked the name of Michael Scheuer.
Mm-hmm.
He also said his agenda was similar to the neoconservatives, so, or that they had similar, they had a similar agenda even though their goals are different.
Right.
So, I don't think it was to discredit Michael Scheuer. I think it was to get people to establish his argument with the source that people would legitimately listen to. Because what Scheuer has been saying repeatedly is the public is not being told the truth about why Bin Laden attacked us.
Right. All right, cool. Hey, thanks a lot for the call, man. Appreciate it.
Sure.
The number is 646-6446-512, 646-6446. And, you know, we kind of touched on these things in the interview with Scheuer, the similarities in American policy and what Bin Laden wants, but I guess not really as, you know, a formulaic thing, not really as a list. But you go down the list and you see, you know, the full-scale invasion of Afghanistan, regime change and all that, the war against Iraq, our threats against the Iranians, pressure against the Assad tyranny in Syria, raised oil prices through the roof. That was on his list of complaints, was the artificially low oil prices in the 1990s. And, well, as Scheuer said, it's our government are the ones, if anybody, who are taking Bin Laden's marching orders, who are doing what he wants. And the list goes on. I mean, even to the point of backing Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon, at least for a short time there, thinking that we could use them to fight Hezbollah. And I think it's a right, you know, that's one of the things, because I kind of thought, you know, this could be fake. You know, they could have enough in here for, you know, to get intelligent people to buy it that, well, yeah, that seems close enough to, you know, what Bin Laden would say or something like that. But that, you know, the way he attacks the Democrats here and so forth for not doing what he would have them do, you know, I could see that being written by somebody in the Bush administration as, you know, some sort of justification to keep us there, to bolster their argument that, see, Bin Laden wants us to leave, and that's why we have to stay and so forth. But, you know, if this was a fake and if it was an inside job, would it be so explicit in saying, haha, your policies have come under the influence of the Mujahideen and you continue to do exactly what we want you to do? You're the bull and we're the matador with the cape and you're a fool, ha ha ha, which is what he says. He says, that's right, my interest is the same as Richard Pearl's. He names Richard Pearl. And says, yes, you're neoconservatives and your wartime corporations, their policies and mine are one and the same, if for different reasons. Pretty crazy. And you know what Pallast says, Greg Pallast? He says that there's a major sense in terms of Iran, there's a major parallel interest there between what the Americans / Saudis want and what Osama bin Laden wants. They want a caliphate. Now, bin Laden could never have one in a million years, and the Saudis presumably couldn't either. But they want iron-fisted control over the price of oil to be set by Riyadh. There's a big Shiite Persia in the way of uniting all the Muslim oil lands between Central Asia and Jordan and so forth, which is what both sides want. Now, of course, bin Laden wants to rule the caliphate, and the Americans and the Saudis would have the family rule the caliphate. But their mutual interest in hurting Iran it's right there on the map in front of your face. There's a big Shiite-controlled Persia in the way. And in this article, he denounces Hezbollah. What are they going to do with that at the Weekly Standard? Asks Justin Raimondo in his column today. What do you guys do at the Weekly Standard when Osama bin Laden denounces... Oh, was it Hamas? Even better. I mean, Hezbollah, Nasrallah, and those guys, they're Shiites. Hamas are Sunni Arabs. It would seem like their organization would have the most in common with Al-Qaeda in that region. But no, they are roundly and completely denounced. What do you do with that, Weekly Standard guys? Bin Laden hates Hamas, who you want us to think is the enemy of America. And goes after the Shiites, names them. Six four six six four four six six four six six four four six 512-646-6446 if you're calling from out of town. And you know what? I just can't get enough of this, man. I'm going to play it for you again, y'all, because I just think it's so great. And I know that there's people in the radio audience who probably have not had a chance to hear this yet. But my friends, this is Dr. Paul in the Republican debate from September the 5th. And just to be clear, our previous guest there, Michael Scheuer, former head of the Bin Laden unit, says, no, Paul is the one who is right, and it's the rest of these clowns who are taking their marching orders from Osama bin Laden. They're the ones following the beat of his war drum. Ron Paul is the only one who understands what we're up against and has a reasonable explanation for how to get us out of this mess. And, really it was hilarious to see Sean Hannity giving Michael Scheuer ultimate credit a couple of days after the debate, treating Michael Scheuer like the expert that he is, when Hannity must know good and well that Scheuer's on the side of Ron Paul in this. Ron Paul, who is Hannity's worst enemy, far before bin Laden. So anyway, why don't you guys stack up those phones while I play this, Ron Paul? It's 512-646-6446, anti-war radio.
Paul, your position on the war is pretty simple. Get out. What about, though, the trying to minimize the bloodbath that would certainly occur if we pull out in a hurry? What about protecting the thousands of Iraqis who have staked their lives in backing the U.S.? And would you leave troops in the region to take out any al-Qaeda camps that are developed after we leave?
The people who say there will be a bloodbath are the ones who said it would be a cakewalk, it would be a slam dunk, and that it would be paid for by oil. Why believe them? They've been wrong on everything they've said. So why not ask the people who advise not to go into the region and into the war? The war has not gone well one bit. Yes, I would leave completely. Why leave the troops in the region? It was the fact that we had troops in Saudi Arabia was one of the three reasons given for the attack on 9/11. So why leave them in the region? They don't want our troops.
Hey, what happened?
Your position on the war is pretty simple. Our lives in backing the U.S.
would be paid for by oil. Why not ask the people who advise not to go into the region and into the war? The war has not gone well one bit. Yes, I would leave completely. Why leave the troops in the region? It was the fact that we had troops in Saudi Arabia was one of the three reasons given for the attack on 9/11. So why leave them in the region? They don't want our troops.
We'll be right back.
position on the war is pretty simple. Get out. What about, though, trying to minimize the bloodbath that would certainly occur if we pull out in a hurry? What about protecting the thousands of Iraqis who have staked their lives in backing the U.S.? And would you leave troops in the region to take out any al-Qaeda camps that are developed after we leave?
The people who say there will be a bloodbath are the ones who said it would be a cakewalk, it would be a slam dunk, and that it would be paid for by oil. Why believe them? They've been wrong on everything they've said. So why not ask the people? Why not ask the people who advise not to go into the region and into the war? The war has not gone well one bit. Yes, I would leave. I would leave completely. Why leave the troops in the region? It was the fact that we had troops in Saudi Arabia was one of the three reasons given for the attack on 9/11. So why leave them in the region? They don't want our troops on the Arabian Peninsula. We have no need for our national security to have troops on the Arabian Peninsula. And going into Iraq and Afghanistan and threatening Iran is the worst thing we can do for our national security. I am less safe. The American people are less safe for this. It's the policy that is wrong. Tactical movements and shifting troops around and taking in 30 more and reducing by 5, totally irrelevant. We need a new foreign policy that said we ought to mind our own business, bring our troops home, defend this country, defend our borders.
So if... So, Congressman Paul, and I'd like you to take 30 seconds to answer this. You're basically saying that we should take our marching orders from al-Qaeda. If they want us off the Arabian Peninsula, we should leave?
No! I'm saying we should take our marching orders from our Constitution. We should not go to war. We should not go to war without a declaration. We should not go to war when it's an aggressive war. This is an aggressive invasion. We've committed the invasion of this war, and it's illegal under international law. That's where I take my marching orders, not from any enemy.
Over this way.
Senator Brownback, you want in on this. What do you have to say?
You go ahead and respond.
The American people didn't go in. A few people advising this administration, a small number of people called the neoconservatives, hijacked our foreign policy. They're responsible, not the American people. They're not responsible. We shouldn't punish them.
Congressman, we are one nation. We can't be divided. We have to be one nation under God. That means if we make a mistake, we make it as a single country, the United States of America,
No. Not
the divided states of America.
When we make a mistake, it is the obligation of the people through their representatives to correct the mistake, not to continue the mistake.
And that's what we do on the floor of the Senate?
No, we've dug a hole for ourselves and we've dug a hole for our party. We're losing elections and we're going down next year if we don't change it. And it has all to do with foreign policy and we have to wake up to this fact.
Even if we lose elections, we should not lose our honor, and that is more important than the Republican Party.
We have lost over 5,000 Americans killed in Afghanistan. We've lost over 5,000 Americans over there in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and plus the civilians killed. How many more do you want to lose? How long are you going to be there? How long? Right. What do we have to pay to save face? That's all we're doing is saving face. It's time
thank
we
you.
Came
gentlemen,
home.
Gentlemen, thank you. Wendell.
Your answer is to cut both taxes and spending. You say that you would eliminate the IRS, the CIA, the Federal Reserve, the Department of Homeland Security, Medicare. I know that you used to want to end the FBI. I'm not sure whether you still support that idea, sir. Perhaps you can tell us. But if you get rid of the CIA, let alone the FBI, how would President Paul have any idea, any intelligence of what our enemies, foreign and domestic, are up to?
Well, you might ask a better question. Before 9/11, we were spending $40 billion a year. And the FBI was producing numerous information about people being trained on airplanes to fly them but not land them. And they totally ignored them. So it's the inefficiency of the bureaucracy that is the problem. So increasing this with the Department of Homeland Security and spending more money doesn't solve the problem. Yes, we have every right in the world to know something about intelligence gathering, but we have to have intelligent people interpreting this information. But, you know, just going for increasing presidential powers, as has been discussed, is rather disturbing to me. This whole idea that we're supposed to sacrifice liberty for security, we were advised against that. Don't we remember that when you sacrifice liberty for security, you lose both? That's what's happening in this country today. We have a national ID card on our doorsteps. It's being implemented right now. We have FISA courts. We have warrantless searches. We've lost habeas corpus. We've had secret prisons around the world, and we have torture going on. That's un-American, and we need to use the power of the presidency to get it back in order to take care of us and protect this country and our liberties.
Thank you, Congressman. Let's see what the people down at Young's Restaurant are making of all this. Carl?
Well, one thing I would remember very clearly is the president doesn't have the authority to go to war. He goes to the Congress.
So what do you do?
He goes to the Congress and finds out if there's any threat to our national security. And thinking back to the 1960s, when I was in the Air Force for 5 years, and there was a Cold War going on, and the Soviets had 40,000, and we stood them down, and we didn't have to have a nuclear confrontation, I would say that we should go very cautiously. We should back off. We should be talking to Iran right now. We shouldn't be looking for the opportunity to attack them. They are at the present time, with, according to AEIA, cooperating, and by the end of the year they're supposed to be willing to reveal all that they are doing. So instead of looking for this scenario where it is inevitable that we have to attack, I think we ought to be talking about how do you get along with some people that are deadly, like the Soviets and the Chinese and the many others. We don't have to resort to war every single time there's a confrontation. They are not a threat to Israel. Israel has 200 or 300 nuclear missiles, and they can take care of themselves. So you shouldn't assume that we have to jump in and go to war, and we certainly shouldn't do it without the consent of the Congress.
Congressman Tancredo, let us...
Another gun issue for you, if you will. You have said that the 9/11 attackers might have had second thoughts if they'd felt that some of the passengers aboard the airplanes might have been armed. We have seen airplanes, air flights diverted because people heard Arabic on planes, because they heard Muslims praying. What do you think it would do to the travel industry of this country if passengers felt others were carrying guns aboard, sir?
Well, first off, you're quoting me incorrectly.
I'm sorry.
I said the responsibility for protecting passengers falls with the airline, not the government. Not the passengers. The airline's responsible for the aircraft and the passengers. If we wouldn't have been dependent on the federal government to set all the rules, which meant no guns and no resistance, then the terrorists may well have had second thoughts because the airlines would have had the responsibility. But we assumed the government was going to take care of us. After 9/11, instead of moving toward the direction of personal responsibility and private property and Second Amendment, we moved in the opposite direction. We turned it over to the federal government, and look at the mess we have now at airports. I mean, the airlines, private industry protects their property all the time. People who haul around money in armored trucks protect their money all the time. But here is one example when the federal government was involved and they messed it up, and if we put the responsibility on the right people, respected the Second Amendment, I sincerely believe there would have been a lot less chance of 9/11 ever happening.
All right, everybody. So that's Ron Paul. Now you understand why he's my favorite politician in, say, all of American history. He makes Thomas Jefferson look like a slave-owning rapist, man. And just so we're clear, I don't worship Ron Paul. I disagree with him vehemently. about what should be done on the American border with Mexico. I disagree with him vehemently on half the issue when it comes to abortion, which I don't want to talk about on the radio because nobody wants to hear that on the radio. But I guess basically he wants it to be illegal, but only on the state level and to be decided by the states. He's against any constitutional amendment or anything like that. I want it to be legal, but I want it decided by the states. And eventually for those states not to exist anymore. But anyway. So I disagree with him about those two things. And I'm trying to remember because I know I disagree with him about at least one or two more things, but I can't remember what they are. Because I know he's right about foreign policy 100%. I know he's right about monetary policy. I know he's right about the imperial presidency and to what degree it must be curtailed, which is just about all the way. I know he's right about his interpretation, his narrow interpretation of the necessary and proper clause in Article 1, Section 8 rather than the broad. Back when he was just a congressman before he was running for president, I used to make bumper stickers that said Ron Paul for Chief Justice. Because I know that he understands what the Constitution means, and he meant it when he took his oath to it, even the parts he disagrees with it about. But, of course, like I always say, the Constitution ain't market anarchy, but it's a hell of a lot better than this. I know he's right about all of the intrusions and violations of the Bill of Rights that have taken place in the last 20 years. In the last 30, 35, if you count, when ever since he's been in Congress. And I know he's consistent in his opposition to all this oppression, too. I've seen clips of him from 1983 arguing about monetary policy. He sounds exactly like him now, only younger. And let's see, I'm trying to remember all the different issues that I know Ron Paul is right about. But really, what else matters except aggressive war and torture, huh? You gonna vote for somebody based on their stand on any issue other than aggressive war and torture? Ron Paul, the anti-aggressive war, anti-torture candidate. If that's not good enough for you, then I don't know what to do with you. Well, yeah, but I heard he wants to abolish the Department of Education. That's done such a great job for everybody in the 35 or so years it's existed. Even though more than a third of fourth graders in government school in America still can't read a simple sentence by the time they're 9 years old. Oh, gee, I just don't know about his abolishing the Department of Education stance there. Yeah, I know he's the only candidate who truly opposes aggressive war and torture. But, you know, gee, in Chris Wallace's list of accusations there and his faux question, didn't he say something about Ron Paul wants to take Medicare and Social Security away from everybody? Gee, it's too bad that the actual question was about how to protect America from terrorists, and Ron Paul in his 25 seconds or what have you didn't have a chance to answer. So it must be that Chris Wallace was telling the truth, right, in his accusation slash question. I mean, if Ron Paul didn't have a chance to answer it, then it must be default correct, whatever Chris Wallace said. But anyway, I don't know what other issues matter other than war and torture. None of them matter to me, except those two issues, really. Ultimately, America's relationship with the whole world, me versus everybody, I like that band, but it's, no, that's not a good foreign policy. And no, I don't want me in alliance with everybody against a few enemies either. You know, I want America to be unilaterally at peace. But, anyways, so yeah. That's my take on it. Ron Paul rules. I wish he was the Chief Justice, really. Wouldn't that be great? Entire swaths of the national government being found unconstitutional every day. Instead, we got Alito and Roberts, two champions of the unitary executive theory of unlimited presidential power, sitting on the Supreme Court until they quit for the rest of their lives. Dang, it's really too bad George Bush didn't appoint Ron Paul to be on the Supreme Court. We wouldn't even need Ron Paul to be the president if he was on the Supreme Court. God, wouldn't that be a dream come true? I can just hear all of his arguments, all of his questions for the Solicitor General, beginning with, are you telling me that... dot, dot, dot. And all the reporters scribbling in their notes, oh, we see where this is headed. Chief Justice Paul and his posse are about to strike this thing down, another thing down. All right, I'm sorry, I'm fantasizing. What would it be like to have a libertarian on the Supreme Court for real? Especially as, like, the Chief Justice. Anyway, yeah, sorry, I'm off. I'm off in diversionary land. So there's a lot of things to address here, but I guess the most important thing, seeing how it's September 10th and so forth, is that the war party is trying to seize on bin Laden's statement to discredit anti-war forces in this country. To say, see, Osama bin Laden wants us out, that's why we must stay. Osama bin Laden wants us out, and that's why Americans who want us out agree with Osama bin Laden. It's already the meme. And we've been warned. We already knew. I think Gareth Porter first brought it up on this show after reading it on Juan Cole's blog last week, where this guy from, New York University? Said he talked to his neocon buddies, and they said they have been instructed by the vice president's office to prepare a major propaganda campaign about Iran. Get ready to ratchet up everything. And in fact, I missed this. I guess I read, I saw the headline or something, and I never did click on it or something when this came out last week. But Ken Silverstein at Harper's Magazine, friend of the show, he talked to a former CIA guy. A former CIA guy who had told him, nah, there's not going to be a war against Iran. Don't worry too much, Ken. It'll be all right. This guy had told him in the past. Well, now this former CIA official, who's quoted anonymously by Ken Silverstein at Harper's Magazine, is saying, I'm not so sure, and in fact now I'd be willing to bet that they are going to bomb Iran. And some of the reasons why, I hope this version I'm looking at has enough of the direct quote here. Looks like it. It looks like there's preparations for military strikes, and I base this on two things, the former CIA official said. On facts that we can observe, and on the rhetoric coming out of the White House, said the former CIA official who worked in the Persian Gulf during the first U.S. war there and served in Iraq after the 2003 invasion. Quote, a massive deployment of troops and equipment in the region is taking place, and the U.S. can't hide that. Sending the U.S. Navy to the Persian Gulf is very expensive, but we have three such units there. Man, I gotta deputize one of you guys to be my aircraft carrier keeper tracker over, or I'm gonna have to pencil in some point on my schedule, you know, every other day or so, and try to keep track of the give and take of these different carrier strike groups in and out of the region there. But anyway, this guy is saying that there are three strike groups there. Is that right? Not last I heard, but anyway. There's a deployment of ships, an increase of supplies, shipments of military supplies, and the general activity level is very high. There's only one region in the world where all this is being deployed to. Moreover, this is the former CIA guy anonymously being quoted by Ken Silverstein at Harper's. Moreover, everyone that I know, pilots and other aviation units, have all disappeared. Usually someone remains, but now all of them have gone at once. Besides unusual activity in the U.S. military, other evidence of possible strikes are harsh statements from the White House. According to the source, the only part of U.S. military forces that isn't strained to the fullest extent is aviation. That is why if there is a military strike on Iran, it will be a days-long multi-target air campaign which will aim a brutal strike on President Ahmadinejad. We should strike not the Iranian aviation or naval bases, but its nuclear objects and the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, the former CIA official believes. He thinks that an unproportionally massive strike on these targets will undermine Ahmadinejad's position inside the country. This is a guy who's warning against it? Well, there you go. Congratulations, Bill Kristol. You did it. You convinced your critics among former CIA agents, the guy that run around and talk with Ken Silverstein over at Harper's. You even got them believing that you're going to undermine the government of Iran by bombing it rather than strengthening them. Wow. I don't know if they're really going to do this or not, but if they do, be prepared for sorrow ahead, man. The consequences are going to be vast, not limited. They're going to be unpredictable, not easy to manage, and as we check them off the list. Oh, don't worry, the Heritage Foundation ran a war game, said everything will be fine. So we don't have to worry. And again, what does Osama bin Laden want? For America to bomb Iran. Now, Scheuer said if he really, really wanted that, immediately, he could be making more of an effort. But perhaps he's realized that he doesn't need to goad us. And we'll go ahead, our government will go ahead and do his dirty work for him anyway. But yeah, it's already started. They're already trying to equate those who oppose endless war against everyone except bin Laden with bin Laden. And they'll probably get away with it, right? Because, you know, it seems like individually people are smart, but en masse, we're just not, are we? En masse, we just say, what? Man, I've heard like 15 times that the surge is working, so the surge is working. I now accept that as a fact because what the hell, I've heard it over and over again. That's really how we are, isn't it? Yeah, the surge is working. Everybody knows the surge is working. Oh, yeah. Anti-war movement, why they agree with Osama bin Laden. Never mind whose fault it is that Osama bin Laden is still podcasting from the Hindu Kush somewhere. Never mind that. Never mind Bush failing to do the number one task on his list since September 11th. Which is to get that son of a bitch. Nope. You're a terrorist because you're anti-war and therefore you agree with Osama bin Laden. Never mind the fact, just pay no mind to the fact whatsoever, that the chief of the CIA's former bin Laden unit has said repeatedly and just said on this show an hour ago that it is the war party who are marching to the beat of Al-Qaeda's drum. That if there's one presidential candidate out of all of them who understands the problem and what is to be done about it, that person is Dr. Ron Paul. That is what Michael Scheuer has said over and over again in writing and again out loud on this show today. So who's taking their marching orders from bin Laden now, Mr. Wallace, huh? This is the Subhumans. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. Be back here tomorrow, 11 to 1 Texas time. Oh, yeah, I forgot the song starts out really, really, really quiet at the beginning. But no, really, the Subhumans is playing. You just got to give it a minute. Oh, no, you don't. You just have to tell me to quit being an idiot and turn the volume up on the damn thing. Well, that's not too hard. Well, it might be difficult to get me to hear you from here, but you know what I mean. Yeah, so what I meant to say was this is the Subhumans then. And yeah, it still does start out quiet at the beginning. Chaos Radio, 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
Thank you. some sexism, teacher to class. From school to work, remain the same. Are you white and middle class?
just do as you are told, and you'll say the same thing to your kids when you're 32 years old. And unless you can react against the brain,